It's Wednesday, November 29th, 2017, and this is KBIA's News of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are my colleagues, Mike McKean and Ernest Perry. On our program this week, the Washington Post sniffs out a tipster who claimed to have been raped by Alabama Senate candidate Roy Moore, and they published her story. The story they published was about her lying to try and trap the Post into rushing into something because it was simply salacious. Time Inc., parent company of Time Magazine, Sports Illustrated, and others, well, it now belongs to Meredith Corporation, will talk about the sale and the influential people pulling strings behind the scenes. And how do you write about a Nazi sympathizer? The New York Times tried it this week, and the outcome? Not so good. But let's begin with today's breaking news from NBC and from MPR, Minnesota Public Radio. The swift firing of both Matt Lauer and Garrison Keillor from their respective organizations there. In Lauer's case, it followed a detailed, credible accusation of sexual misconduct from another NBC employee. NBC Chairman Andy Lack issued a statement announcing the move, which Today Show co-host Savannah Guthrie read on the air right before saying this.
We just learned this moments ago, just this morning. As I'm sure you can imagine, we are devastated and we are still processing all of this. And I will tell you right now, we do not know more than what I just shared with you. But we will be covering this story as reporters, as journalists. I'm sure we will be learning more details in the hours and days to come. And we promise we will share that with you. Mm-hmm. And Hoda, I mean, you know, for the moment, all we can say is that we are heartbroken. I'm heartbroken for Matt. He is my dear, dear friend and my partner, and he is beloved by many, many people here. And I'm heartbroken for the brave colleague who came forward to tell her story and any other women who have their own stories to tell. Mm-hmm. And we are grappling with a dilemma that so many people have faced these past few weeks. How do you reconcile your love for someone with the revelation that they have behaved badly? Mm-hmm. And I don't know the answer to that. But I do know that this reckoning that so many organizations have been going through is important, it's long overdue, and it must result in workplaces where all women, all people, mm-hmm. feel safe and respected. As painful as it is, this moment in our culture and this change had to happen.
Yeah, it did. This is a very tough morning for both of us. I've known Matt for 15 years, and I've loved him as a friend and as a colleague. And again, just like you were saying, Savannah, it's hard to reconcile what we are hearing with the man who we know, who walks in this building every single day. We were both woken up with the news kind of pre-dawn, and we're trying to process it and trying to make sense of it, and it'll take some time for that.
I was woken up with the news, too. Actually, my dad texted me as soon as it happened. My dad actually told me about both of these, hearing about them almost immediately as the word came out about it. Both of these were different, and I want to talk about Matt Lauer first. In the sense from what we've seen in the past in the situations with Charlie Rose or with Mark Halperin, that those stories were broken first by the New York Times, by the Washington Post, with both Matt Lauer and Garrison Keillor. These came out before stories about them could, and with Matt Lauer, these allegations coming to NBC Monday night, such a swift move.
Yeah, and I think NBC needed to do it. Not only was it the right thing to do, they needed to do it given the way that they were scooped on the Weinstein story and some others. But it's also true that apparently, if you read some of the reporting that Brian Stelter and others have done, mm-hmm. that both the New York Times and Variety had been investigating Matt Lauer and several claims against him for some time now. So they may have just barely beaten the other media to the punch.
Yeah, excuse me. When I first heard this, that was the first thing that popped in my mind, was that someone else has a story and they're about to release the story, so NBC had to act. I'm sure that they knew something was coming down the pike, and they were trying to make sure that they had all their HR processes and all those things together before they could act, and they had the opportunity to do that before today's show. I mean, otherwise, I think they would have just let it play out until they had all that, but I think they probably felt like, we have enough to do this now, plus we want to beat whatever story is going to be coming out.
One of the clips that are being played over and over again by cable news networks today and some other places, The interview that Matt Lauer did with Bill O'Reilly, in which he asks him very specifically, you know, you had to have been the very last person that Fox News wanted to fire. There had to have been such compelling evidence against you. You are the man for that network. Hearing that now, it's almost eerie. It's kind of creepy. Matt Lauer's in that exact same situation.
He is, and it's not all that different, you know, from the CBS situation either. I mean, Charlie Rose, there's videos going around about all kinds of sexually charged language on the set of CBS Morning News. So the irony isn't lost on any of us, I don't think.
Yeah, I mean, when you go back and you think about all the interviews that Charlie Rose did, and I'm sure if you go back and look at some of those interviews, either on his show or on CBS or in other places, he asked the people who were interviewing some similar harsh questions around that particular subject. And now he finds himself in that same situation. Matt Lauer finds himself in that situation. What I think what's happening here is that you have women and others who now feel as if they can really come out and speak to these issues. And you have news organizations that are covering these stories. I mean, they are pursuing these issues. What I find interesting in all of this is that I'm sure that they knew about this in the past. So I had been told these things in the past and probably felt like, hey, this is not a story we want to pursue. But now all of a sudden with Weinstein and with Charlie Rose and with all the others that have come out and the political climate that we have now, including some of the things that's happened with the president, it opens the door for these kinds of stories to now come out.
I thought there were a couple of other clips this morning, and you had one of them on our links blog that were in, and you just played one of them from Savannah Guthrie, mm-hmm. for example, and Hoda Kotb saying basically they were totally shocked. He was our friend. We loved him. We're trying to square all of this. Compare that to the video clip from Megyn Kelly, also on the Today Show, where she's been through the whole thing with sexual harassment at Fox. She was much less conciliatory toward Matt Lauer, and I'm wondering if she may be the new co-anchor of the main first couple of hours of the Today Show after all of this.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how these shows change, mm-hmm. because now you have the top male anchor for Today gone, the top male anchor for CBS gone. So now how does this play out? It's almost like people are going to be sitting back and looking and going like, okay, when is the shoe going to drop on ABC?
And that was one of the things that I wanted to ask you. ABC is kind of in this interesting position, and I want to get a sense from you of, are they in a position of competitive advantage, or are they in a position of extreme vulnerability? Because people may be looking at ABC going, okay, it happened at CBS, okay, it happened at NBC, what's in your house?
You know, they could be in a vulnerability. Because, you know, Michael Strahan moved into that show, mm-hmm. and he has a history that played out while he was an NFL player, while he was doing NFL Today. I mean, it's not along the lines of that, but he has a history of issues related to women and his treatment of women and that sort of thing. So, you know, that could play a role in what ABC does. But that history's already out there. It's been covered. Those stories are out there. The question becomes, what happens with the other male anchor who
George Stephanopoulos.
Thank you. Who was a Clinton aide, right. As we've also been talking about Bill Clinton's
Well,
past.
I mean, unless we find out something about Stephanopoulos, I mean, I don't think necessarily Strahan's the equivalent. Yeah. And Good Morning America has been competitive or even in first place, right. over the Today Show for a while.
It has been a very tight horse race, frankly, yeah. going back to the time when there was the Ann Curry debacle that was so much the result of Matt Lauer's hand was in that.
And there's a lot of conversation out there, especially when you go and look at the stories and the comments where people are saying, I don't feel sorry for Matt Lauer because of what he did in the Ann Curry situation.
And can I just say before we move on to the next one that—
Yes, please.
Does our president have no shame? He's tweeting about Matt Lauer this morning, and this is just like, 24, 48 hours after he's starting to deny the accuracy of the Access Hollywood tape? I mean, come on.
Are you surprised?
Right. He's also made some other questionable moves on Twitter today, too, that if we were a political show, might be worth talking about.
I mean,
but yeah.
He made comments after Charlie Rose. He made comments about he's tweeted about Roy Moore more positively than these others. But, you know, at each one of these instances, he's felt the need to weigh in via Twitter.
You know, Mike, it kind of kills me that you said before we talk about the next one, but we do. We need to talk about the next one. Just when I thought today's show was rewritten for the final time after my 11 o'clock class, again, another call from my dad. Did you hear about Garrison Keillor? And the details on this one are still pretty scant.
Yeah, I mean, he still works for Minnesota Public Radio, even though he hasn't been
well,
the host
of Well, he did until a few
He off, did you know? Until he was fired.
Doesn't anymore.
Right. But, I mean, he hosted Prairie Home Companion, as we know, for many, many years. After he stepped aside and somebody else took that job, he's been producing another show. And also his company provides repeats, kind of like Car Talk used to do all the time. And now Minnesota Public too. Radio has said,
yeah.
You're fired. We're not going to distribute your old programs. And we're going to rename the show that has a new host now to something else.
Yeah, when I saw that, I was like, whoa, wait a minute. You know, it starts to make me think, what exactly did he do for you to just totally disavow and change the name? I mean, that's going to hurt what you're trying to do in building that program.
Well, and in the scant details that we have, what it says is that we know that this happened because Garrison Keillor himself sent an email to the Associated Press. And in it, and somewhere here I have a copy of the story, and I don't want to misquote him, but what he was saying is that it was a story. This is his exact quote. He was fired over a story that, quote, I think is more interesting and more complicated than the version NPR heard.
Which is definitely not an apology. I don't know what it is. And we have heard nothing from Matt Lauer yet, by the way, either. Right. So I'd be curious to hear how that plays out.
One thing I should mention, of course, everybody knows Prairie Home Companion was heard here on KBIA for years and years. KBIA obviously stopped running that program at the time that Garrison Keillor retired from it. And the other show that he had been working on, KBIA does not have any connection with. But I felt like we had to at least acknowledge that Garrison Keillor, he was synonymous with public radio for so, so many years. There was still a lot I wanted to make sure we had a chance to talk about today. It's frankly what I spent all day yesterday thinking about. So let's get to some of that, including that Washington Post story. Post doing what reporters do, listening and fact-checking. Let me tell you what happened if you hadn't been caught up on this. It all started with a woman named Jamie Phillips who contacted the Post and said that Roy Moore impregnated her as a teenager. Over the course of 2 weeks, she shared her dramatic story about this alleged sexual relationship with the Senate candidate, which occurred supposedly in 1992 and led to an abortion when she was 15 years old. According to Post reporters, the woman, Jamie Phillips, asked repeatedly for their opinions on what her claims could mean for his candidacy if she went public. The reporters did what reporters do, dodged her questions and checked out her story. Here is a clip from their final conversation published on the Washington Post website late Monday afternoon.
I want you to know that this is being recorded and video recorded. So if there's anything you want to say about why you're here and how you came to be sitting here, I really would like to know that story as well.
I mean,
we're planning to write a story about this, so this would probably be a good opportunity if you want to explain a little bit more and about all this.
I mean, I really don't. I mean, I told you already that I wasn't even sure that I wanted to go through with the story at all.
Yeah.
So, you know.
Yeah.
So I think I probably just want to cancel and not go through with it at this point.
Okay. And do you want to explain any more about how it was that how you came to call us and?
No, I just saw an article last. I saw that article that was posted, and that's how I reached out for Ben.
Uh huh. And are you in contact with other people? Are you in contact with the Roy Moore campaign
or
Steve Bannon or Breitbart?
No,
not at all. Uh-huh. So did your do you still have an interest in, as this says, combating the lies and deceit of the liberal MSM? Do you still have an interest in working in the conservative media movement to combat the lies and deceit of the liberal MSM? Is that still your interest?
No, not really.
According to the TikTok that the Washington Post published Monday, the paper's reporting showed that that woman actually worked for Project Veritas, a group that, according to its website, investigates and exposes corruption, dishonesty, self-dealing, waste, and fraud through the use of undercover journalists. If you're watching us, you saw the air quotes. If not, I made them. Here's what happened when the paper tried to confirm her connection to the group.
Does Jamie Phillips work for Project Veritas? Did you guys send her to speak to pose as a victim of Roy Moore to the Washington Post?
I'm 15 minutes late to this meeting, so okay. I gotta run, but we will get in touch with you, okay?
Jamie Phillips, does she work for the Washington Post? Does she work for Project Veritas?
Not here? No. I'm not gonna answer the question.
So that was the group's founder, James O'Keefe, who was not answering the question. So the headlines here, group trying to prove media bias does exactly the opposite?
Well, and this is the modus operandi of James O'Keefe for a long time in Project Veritas. You may recall back in the day when, with some tricky editing of video, basically he wiped out the organization Acorn that used to lobby on behalf of poor people. They did an expose, a hidden camera expose with NPR, a couple of fundraisers who said some things that's purported to show liberal bias. And that's the thing that they're trying to entrap people into doing. And that's what the Post just exposed, that they were trying to entrap them into saying some things about Roy Moore in the context of bringing this salacious story to them. And the Post didn't fall for it.
And that's the thing that I really want to sort of highlight and commend the Post for, basically following standard journalistic guidelines, which
they did
is
what they were supposed to do,
out,
and it worked.
Check it out, and it works. And even going even further than that, to say, you know, not only are we going to check it out, we're going to check it out, and then when it doesn't play out, we're going to expose you for who you are and what you're doing. And I think that more and more news organizations are going to do this when they run into someone who's trying to entrap them. I mean, yeah, they could have just said, no, we're not going to run the story, we just found this out, and just let it go. But they said, no, we're going to expose you. And I think that's what needs to be done in these instances when you have organizations out there that are basically trying to craft a narrative that is, to use the president's words, fake.
So here's my concern. As much as I love everything that you just said, it was the Washington Post that took the time, that followed each of these breadcrumbs, and that found this out and exposed it. What happens in a smaller newsroom that doesn't have the resources, that doesn't have the people? Better likelihood of falling for the trap, running with the story, because it's just too good not to run?
I mean, there's a possibility of that happening, yeah. But after the Post was able to do this and show other journalism organizations about what's happening, maybe their eyes will be open and they'll ask one or two more questions that can lead to answers that just don't make sense, that just don't add up.
I hope you're right about that.
I hope I am, too.
But I'll say this. I mean, the Project Veritas people just a month ago entrapped a New York Times social media editor into basically saying some things about how, oh, I don't believe in objectivity and that kind of stuff. And that's the New York Times. The Washington Post, in fact, had to issue a memorandum, I think, yesterday or the day before that, telling all their people in their newsroom, be very, very careful. Don't let folks come in asking questions, even if they say they're working on, you know, academic research or whatever, because they expect more of this entrapment behavior.
And I think it is going to happen, because now these organizations feel emboldened to do this because of the heightened polarized political environment that we're in. All of these stories, the stories we talked about early on with the sexual allegations and people being fired, what's happening on Capitol Hill involving various Senate and House of Representatives
members.
So now you've got this environment where you have organizations like this that can go out and say, hey, we can expose certain frailties of the media and present them in a way that diminishes, you know, what they do and who they are in the entire political arena and cultural arena as well.
Okay, well, and I felt bad when we sat here 2-3 weeks ago and I asked in what I thought was a moment of betraying the sisterhood of, are we sometimes moving a little too fast on some of these claims? Are we being fair? In this case, it was one where they could have run with it and claimed Roy Moore had impregnated a 15-year-old and she had to have an abortion, which wouldn't have happened. Right. So maybe we do need to take that step and be more skeptical. Before these stories all broke, there was another one that journalism insiders were talking about, only this one not in such complimentary ways and not with so much pride in the work of our professional peers. It was the weekend feature from the New York Times on an Ohio man who identifies as a member of the far right. He's a Nazi sympathizer, or as so many said in their harsh critiques about this story, he's simply a Nazi, and the New York Times tried to humanize him or normalize him, pointing out he likes pasta and Seinfeld, frankly, just like I do.
Yeah, you know, I saw the article, I saw the headline, yeah. And I was going to go back and read it. I was traveling over the weekend, yeah. And as soon as I got back home and was sitting at my computer, opened my email, and boom, there was this long email from one of my academic mentors, mm-hmm. saying, "You've got to read this story. This is the worst piece of journalism I've seen all year." And so I opened
it up. Wow, that's quite the
yeah, and coming from her, I mean, that's powerful. So I opened it up and I read it, and I went like, oh, wow, wait a minute, hold up. And then I read the comments, which goes to what you were talking about earlier. I think the problem here is that they humanized him. And it's all about him and his wife. And it's not, there's nothing there that provides what we talk about on the show all the time, which is context.
Oh, he said it.
The context was missing about the fact that he's a part of this organization. And it's white nationalists, and he's espousing this. And how does that play out in the much larger contextual atmosphere that we're in right now? And then for the New York Times to come back and try to explain in the same edition of the paper, here's why we did it. Yes, we understand that there's a problem with it, but we thought it was important. Well, if you understood it was a problem with it, why did you run it? I don't get it.
You know, I think you can argue this a couple of different ways, and I rarely disagree with you, Ernest, but here's one where I'm going to be the contrary.
Okay. All right. Okay? Go ahead.
I mean, first of all, if you read the story, I mean, I think there is the context that this was a guy who was at Charlottesville. Okay? This is a guy who, you know, is part of Trump's core, and they want to expose this guy. Remember how many, was it a week or two after the election, all the media were gnashing their teeth about how we didn't see this coming. We don't understand, you know, who the people are that support Trump. We don't understand what's going on there. Here is a story that reflects this guy who has really bad ideas about Jews and African Americans and you name it, but he is in some ways seen as very normal
in his
neighborhood.
So let me push back on you.
I like that story.
Okay, well, but let me push back a little bit on you on that then. Yep. If this is going to be good journalism, I one of the very first thoughts I had about this was thinking back to a book that I didn't really read, I listened to on tape, that was written by Warren Littlefield, who was the executive at CNN who greenlit, eventually, Seinfeld. Seinfeld, which was not going to go on the air because it was seen as too urban, and by too urban and too metropolitan, it was the undertone of too Jewish. So why not, on some level, go ahead and challenge this normalized Nazi by saying, how can you be the far-right sympathizer, but I'm supposed to relate to the fact that you like this show that kind of sort of portrays a culture that you're so far against.
Okay, so the argument is that we're normalizing this guy. Here are just two sentences from this story. I don't want you, this is a quote from the guy, uh-huh. By the reporter. I don't want you to think I'm some edgy Republican, he says, while flatly denouncing the concept of democracy. I don't even think these things should be edgy, he says, while defending his assertion that Jews run the worlds of finance and the media. The reporter's calling him out throughout the story.
I don't have a problem with running the story when it's ready. This story was not ready. There was other reporting that needed to be done. There are other angles that needed to be done. There was more context that needed to be brought into the story. I'm with you on the fact that, yeah, we do need to expose these types of individuals and show the world that there is some everydayness to them, if you can use that term. But however, that's all that was there. And the other parts of it wasn't there. And if they'd have brought that in, I would not have had a problem at all running the story.
I mean, I think the reporter acknowledged the problem he had, which was, I thought I was going to be able in the end to tell you how this guy went from whatever he was to a Nazi sympathizer. And after all the interviews, and I don't really know why.
Yeah, we don't get that.
But I'll bet that's true about an awful lot of the president's supporters who might have been at Charlottesville or whatever.
No,
we can't have all the answers.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. I'll leave it at that.
Okay. So let's, in the time we have left, shift gears a bit and talk about the business of the media. A big merger announced this week. Meredith Corporation is buying up Time, Inc., the parent company of Time Magazine, Sports Illustrated, People Magazine, among a handful of others. But the big news here isn't as much the merger as who's footing a good chunk of the bill, the Koch brothers. How exactly was this deal structured?
Well, so Meredith, which is based in Des Moines, is paying $3 billion in cash, basically. The Koch brothers gave $650 million to help finance the deal. And so basically, that's the cost side of it. But the folks at Meredith think they're going to save like $500 million in the next 2 years by consolidating. So it makes sense for Meredith. There are a lot of people saying that, you know, in Time Inc., that they're gnashing their teeth, woe is me, we're losing our stature because this, you know, corn-fed Midwestern magazine publisher is buying us out. But on the Meredith side, it makes plenty of sense.
No, it makes a lot of sense for Meredith. I mean, I could also see them selling off a couple of those magazines that are part of Time Inc. in order to recoup some of what they spent to buy the entire company, and they do get some to expand their brand some, and they can also bring in a lot of the new media and the digitization and the consumer connection that Meredith has built out that Time has tried to do over the years and has been unable to do.
What kind of influence do we think we might be seeing from the Koch brothers, given how much they poured into it?
It depends on what's being kept. I think if they keep Time, then the Koch brothers could have some influence there. But who knows? They may wind up selling that part of it off or Sports Illustrated or something else.
I mean, Meredith says we're not giving them a seat on our board. The Koch people say it was basically a financial investment. We don't want to have any impact on the content. I don't know. We'll see. There are other ways they could have an impact besides influencing the news coverage. They could get access to the data that the Time Inc. publications gather from their publications online, and they might merge that with political data. So there's other ways they could benefit.
Yeah, I mean, they're gonna figure out a way to monetize that in a way that I think Time Warner just wasn't able to do.
Okay, well, I'm looking at the clock and we don't have enough time left to talk about all the things that I was really hoping that we would be able to. So I'm going to make a promise right now to our audience to bring back the net neutrality discussion that we were going to have next week, because we do have 2 weeks before there's going to be movement on that. That music means we are out of time. Thank you for spending the last half hour with us. You can read more about the topics we talked about today on our Links blog. That's under the Programs tab at kbia.org. To those of you who watched us on Facebook Live today, thank you for being with us. You can also follow us on Twitter. Our handle there is @viewsonkbia. These are all great ways to watch and listen to our program again, to leave us comments, questions, see previews of what else we will be talking about next week, and more. Our thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan for directing today's show, and to Aaron Hay for handling the audio. Tim Pilcher composed our original theme music. Chelsea Preby and Allison Pecorin are our associate producers. I'm Amy Simons, and we'll both be back with you next week for another edition of Views of the News.